C.S. Lewis argued that God doesn't find man's desire for pleasure too strong, but too weak. I think it's also true that God doesn't find the Christian man's interest in politics too powerful, but actually too pathetic. I know that the, and I have this in scare quotes in my notes, idol of politics. I know that the idol of politics is a favorite rented car for preachers to try to drive through every wall they see, who say that Christians act like politics or politicians can save them. But I just have never met any Christian who at least is going to admit that that is what they think. I've just never met one of them. Maybe they exist somewhere, but I don't know any Christian. I have not talked to one who actually thinks, oh, if we could just get the right president, then we would all be saved. I don't know anybody who's ever actually claimed that. And most of the preachers who fear the dreaded inevitable compromise from Christians spending too much time about politics, most of those preachers who are afraid of the idol of politics, who are afraid of the inevitable compromise, I really think that those preachers are just ignorant. Thank you. Ben, I appreciate that. It is intentionally a pokey statement. I think that those preachers know how to speak about the gospel, but they don't actually know how to disciple their people to obey all that Jesus commanded, which is the Great Commission, which includes how to obey Jesus when you're living with other people, whether that's other people in your house or your neighborhood or your city or your state or your nation. And I say those preachers are ignorant. I think it is a lot easier to say that someone else is wrong for messing with something that you don't know about than it is to actually say that you're wrong for not getting messy. So I think that those preachers are afraid of getting messy, and so they just complain about everybody else. And politics is messy. That's because politics involves a whole lot of neighbors, and neighbors are sinners, and sinners have problems. This morning, in Psalm 2, I gave the definition of politics, where individuals or parties having or hoping to achieve power is a basic definition or included in the basic definition of politics. Individuals or parties having or hoping to achieve power, and every last one of those people or parties are sinners. They're going to have conflict. Even our saved neighbors are at best immature. Even our saved neighbors are not yet fully like Christ. And the best case scenario is that we've got immature Christians that we're trying to live with. On some level, there's various stages of immaturity, obviously. But that's the best case scenario, is that our neighbors are immature Christians, and then the slide into immorality is short and a long way down. I think we can definitely thank God for our founding fathers who planted some trees, and I have in my mind, I looked for a picture of it online, but nothing really stood out to me. But at least in cartoon movies, when the key characters go over a cliff, if they're lucky, there's like a branch hanging out halfway down the cliff that they can grab onto, or either that they fall on and, you know, hurt in unpleasant ways or whatever. At least our founding fathers planted some trees that have some roots sticking out in various parts of the cliffs that while we're falling, we're at least not falling as fast as we can, because we keep trying to claw onto different branches as we plummet down to the bottom. We are falling. So, like I said, I think that this is because Christians have not cared enough about politics, government, laws, and justice. It's not that Christians have cared too much about it. They have cared too little about it. Now, not everyone among us has the same experience, of course, but many of us have been told, we have been lectured, that caring about politics is wrong, that you are wrong to be interested in politics, let alone to participate in political life. We have been told that our citizenship is in heaven, which it is, Philippians chapter 3, verse 20. We have been told that we are not to set our minds on the things of earth, which is true in one way, Colossians chapter 3, verse 2. But that's just too simplistic. And in fact, it's disobedient to God, who is the one who made us citizens of heaven while still leaving us here. Like, that's his fault. So, making us citizens of heaven, that's good, take us to heaven. But he made us citizens of heaven with responsibilities for being citizens here. And that has application to whatever set of neighbors were nearby. I really enjoyed J.I. Packer's introduction to John Owen's book, The Death of Death and the Death of Christ. I was thinking about it recently because some of the seniors taking capstone have been reading J.I. Packer's introduction. And Packer unpacks, Andy, that was just for you. Packer unpacks a three-word statement that challenges so much man-centeredness today, including in the church. Packer's point as he's introducing this book is that God saves sinners. And that is gold smelt seven times with a stamp of a tulip on top of the bar. God saves sinners is like the long ballast of your boat. But there is another three-word confession that is even better, maybe. A three-word confession that comes directly from the Bible, and it is actually more like the mountain for your gold or the ocean for your boat. So if God saves sinners is your gold and your ballast, the other three-word confession is even better, and that is Jesus is Lord. Every Christian has to confess it. Romans chapter 10, verse 9 requires it. You can't be a Christian without making this confession. Obviously, there's much to explain in that confession about who Jesus is and what he has done and why he is Lord, including that God raised him from the dead, that he came, that he died, that he was raised from the dead. But, you know, I'm not being critical of Packer's comment. I really like it. God saves sinners. That's fantastic in terms of God's sovereignty and salvation. But isn't it possible that Christians even can study the soteriology of that and come away with it still thinking that God means that God way up in heaven who's not super involved saves sinners to get them to heaven for eternity? And that's all good. But Jesus is Lord emphasizes Jesus, his human name, when God became incarnate and dwelt among men. And he is Lord, which has application not just for heaven and eternity, but for immediately, for right now. In fact, the Jews persuaded the Romans to crucify Jesus because of this claim. They blackmailed Pilate for supporting some other political leader rather than Caesar. And so Pilate was part of helping put Jesus to death. Jesus is Lord is a first principle. And from that ocean, an almost limitless network of reverse tributaries flow. I had to look that up because tributaries apparently are the little streams that flow into the bigger body of water. So technically, it'd have to be reverse tributaries coming out of the ocean. But Jesus is Lord is the ocean from which a vast network of reverse tributaries flow. Tributaries for our obedience and for our interests and for our investment. So saying and confessing that Jesus is Lord, of course that means that we're supposed to obey him rather than men or governments when they conflict. Of course, this means that we must acknowledge him before men, but it also means, if this is a tributary flowing out of this ocean confession, it also means that we must figure out how to serve the Lord in our relations among men, with our neighbors, in the various contracts and responsibilities that we enter into with them. In the parable of the talents, Matthew chapter 25, Jesus describes a master. It could be translated Lord. It is the Greek word kurios, the word used to describe Jesus himself regularly in the New Testament. In the parable of the talents, a master gives his servants an unequal amount, but still a part of his property for them to use. One got five talents, another got two talents, another just one. And verse 15 actually emphasizes to each according to his ability. Five, two, one, each according to his ability. And then the master went away. When the master returned, he found that the first two had invested and made profit. The last had buried the money, though he hadn't at least lost the one talent. He hadn't lost the capital. But the master shared wealth with his servants and expected their stewardship. And by way of application, our Lord has given us talents, and talents as a monetary description in the parable, but he has given us actually more forms of wealth and property than just money. The Lord has also given us wealth in the form of skills, time, opportunity. He's given us wealth in the form of technology, wealth in the form of books to learn, wealth in the form of medicine to get out of more pain to do more things, wealth in the form of medicine to stay around longer, wealth in the form of electricity to stay up and be on the internet and communicate with one another, wealth in the form of food. We are living in the single most wealthy country ever, not just by our gross national product, but also in terms of our Constitution. How wealthy are we in the Constitution that God has allowed us to have? What wealth we have, even amidst the corruption and the bribery and the backroom deals. People are still trying to get in here because the bribery is at least not as bad. So constitutionally, we have been given great wealth. Our legislative, executive, and judicial branches, our local, state, national governments, we are a wealthy political people. Now, if one of the servants in Jesus' parable had taken off with his master's talents, let's say he got the talent from his master and crossed the border into Mexico. They weren't near Mexico, but we're in the United States, so we're making it closer to home. If one of those servants had taken the master's talents across the border and claimed that all of the talents were his, and then tried to ignore that he had a master that he would eventually have to give an account to, yes, that would be bad. So we can't claim that all of these things are just ours to do with whatever we want and that we don't have to give an account for it. But in this illustration, we have been given a diverse political portfolio from the Lord. And how are we investing it? What is the return on the wealth that we have been given by the Lord that we are going to give account for when he returns? The servant who buried his talent would not have impressed his master by saying, "I know I didn't do anything with the talent, but I studied the exchange rates every morning in my devotions." That would have not been sufficient. Having good devotions is really good, and not a stewardship of the wealth that we have been given in so many ways. Jesus is Lord means something, and it motivates everything, including our investment of his gifts to us in our government, including his gifts that we are to vest in a variety of the spheres that we have responsibilities in, but that includes government. So the master didn't promise the servants that they would win the stock market, but he did expect them to try. I used to be one of those Christians who thought that God only cared about spiritual, Bible, gospel, churchy thingies. But that math and history and science and politics were things that we, the people, we just had them. God didn't really care about those very much at all. I had assumed in, without knowing the right word, I had assumed in this idea of neutrality. Religious people, including the committed irreligious people, all had camps around the outside of this big shared public square in the middle. This is the public square in Wittenberg. Ironically, it's got a big statue of Martin Luther right in the middle of it, but forget about that for a moment. The big public square in the middle was a place that everybody could come from there where they lived on the outside of that. And all kinds of people had their own places where they lived. So the Christians had a camp, and you know, the Muslims had a camp, and the atheists had a camp. Everybody's got their own camp on the outside. But then when you left your camp, you came into this great big middle public square place, and we, the people, just had some things that we agreed together that we would share. Now, I was never one of the people that thought leaving my Christian camp and entering the public square meant that I had to deny which camp I was from. I never went that far. But the point of going into the public square was to convince people to go back to their camp and pack up their things and move over to the Christian side. But that was all that the public square was really good for. Just for Christians to, you know, like that hungry, hungry hippo game. And all the balls get put out in the middle, and you know, you're just trying to get them back into your side. But again, it wasn't like anybody owned that public square in particular. And now I realize how disrespectful that is to the Lord of the whole field. That's actually crazy, disobedient, and disrespectful to the Lord of the public square. Does this mean that we should care about being a Christian nation? Well, leaving aside the question for the moment about what that would actually look like in the nitty-gritty, can we say that the Lord does not want us to care about whether or not our nation honors him? Can we say that Jesus says, because he's Lord, can we say that Jesus says he doesn't care if anybody calls him by name? Can we show from his word, from the Lord's word, that he refuses to be acknowledged by rulers and judges? Don't use my name for stuff, guys. Like, you just do that part there. And then, like, at church, that's fine. But that's a different sphere. That's a different place where you'll be. So over there, that's fine. But when you're out in the public square, like, people think you're weird. So just forget about it. Can we say that that is what our Lord's attitude is towards our involvement in the public square? If you are a king or a president or a governor or a city council member, he wants you to be quiet. That's not true. If I could be a higher lesser magistrate, because you can get pretty low in your magistrations, if I could be a higher lesser magistrate for a day, I'd be in favor of replacing "On Our Money and God We Trust" with "Jesus is Lord." Why not? Acknowledge him as the Lord of it all. Now, a couple things that this is not. This is not driven by eschatology, at least of the post-millennial kind. In the reading that I've done, and even in some of what I'm about ready to say, some of the things that I am saying are very regularly said by post-millennialists. That is the ones who believe that the gospel is going to conquer in very obvious and national ways until such time as the whole earth, or the majority of it, don't know exactly what the percentage is, but the majority of the earth is ready then for Jesus to return and be its king. I don't actually think that. It may sound similar in some respects, but we want the Lord to be pleased with our obedience while he's gone rather than the earth to be prepared in order for his return. That is not the same thing. So what I'm describing is not driven by a post-millennial eschatology. Also in some of what I am about to say, dispensationalists are the big target of idiots who are like the worst. So, and yet I still would claim to be one of those. So apparently you can have a mix of things. You don't have to have them all in super tight categories. But I'd also say this is not driven by logic per se, other than a logic of obedience to Christ's lordship. So if he is Lord, then every one of the things that we do ought to be in acknowledgement that he is Lord. So what should we call this? There are some key terms in the discussion, whether or not those terms need to be accepted or rejected or modified. When we talk about Jesus as Lord recognized in our governmental levels, so city, state, nation, some people want to call it a theocracy. Some people would refer to it more with the word theonomy. Theodicy is a word that sounds kind of like the first two, but actually has nothing to do with them. So I'm going to define it anyway, because it's easy to get confused. I am not in favor of using the word theocracy to describe what we're after. I know that there are people who use the word theocracy. The word theocracy has, and all of these have the theo in them. The theo is the theos, meaning God. The crossy part is from kratos, meaning power. The nami part is from namos, meaning law. And the disi part, I don't even remember. It's related to justice. Dikaiosune is the longer righteousness term. But theocracy is how God is in power over a particular political system. But in looking at some dictionary definitions, theocracy seems to have a very specific and tight meaning. So I've got some examples. A system of government in which priests rule in the name of God or a god. And this is the New Oxford American Dictionary, and you can actually see that they describe a theocracy in Israel from Moses up until Saul was crowned as king. As soon as Saul was crowned as king, then they were no longer a theocracy. They were not a nation ruled by God through priests, through religious leaders. It's not just that dictionary. The Merriam-Webster Online Dictionary says a government of a state by immediate divine guidance or by officials who are regarded as divinely guided, which is more the religious leader's idea rather than kings. Dictionary.com says a form of government in which God or a deity is recognized as the supreme civil ruler. That part of it is fine. The gods or deities' laws being interpreted by the ecclesiastical authorities or by the church people. That part is not good. That's not separating church and state in any kind of way and saying that there isn't a state apart from the religious leaders, in this case even the church people. One other, the Cambridge Dictionary says a country that is ruled by religious leaders. And again, I think that that is not leaders who are religious, but religious groups and leaders there. So like I said, Israel was a theocracy, but only for a while until they demanded a king. The distinction was exactly that they did not want God's immediate rule through the priests. They wanted a king, a civil king. Now, a similar word is theonomy, a combination of the words theo and nomos, so God's law. And when Saul took over, Israel was not a theocracy anymore, but Israel was still a theonomy. He was king, but he was following laws given by God, starting with the Ten Commandments. So dictionary.com, and actually not even all the dictionaries have theonomy. They don't even recognize it as a word. I got red squiggly lines in my app while I was typing my notes, not recognizing it as a word, but it's a word. The state of an individual or society that regards its own nature and norms as being in accord with the divine nature. That's just one definition. I think it's serviceable. Quickly, none of these are theodicy, which is the relationship about how a sovereign, providentially involved God who supposedly is good can also be reconciled with the existence of evil. So theodicy is the question about how a good God can allow bad things. That's theodicy, which maybe depending on how you voted for President Trump, you think theodicy is related to this discussion. But that theodicy is not my main point in what I'm talking about. What both theocracy, again, where God directly or God through religious leaders ruling a nation or people, what theocracy and theonomy, the law of God, share in common, obviously, is that idea of God. And if you don't capital T the theonomy, well, that could be any God. Obviously, it could be the God of the Bible, the triune God. But this is the inescapable principle that there is actually always a God or gods of any system. Whether it is admitted and recognized, declared outright or not, there is always some God of the system. Always. Even if the God of the system is a principle denying God's existence. That's still a ruling principle. It's still the God-like thing above the system, denying that there is no God. So, and I took 2 years of French, but, you know, alouette. Ni Dieu ni maître is the French rallying cry. This is a paper, if you can see up at the very top, from 1885, but it was a phrase that was actually started in the late 1700s during the French Revolution. This was the battle cry of the French Revolution: neither God nor master, we want none of it. We want no God, we want no master, singular, plural. And this became the God of the French Revolution, was a denial of God. Significantly, the French phrase appears twice in Friedrich Nietzsche's work, Beyond Good and Evil, which is not a pleasant book. The phrase, no God, no master, also appears regularly in Margaret Sanger's book, The Woman Rebel, an 8-page monthly newsletter which promoted contraception using the slogan, no gods, no masters. Sanger insisted that every woman was the mistress of her own body. She was her own god. There were no gods, no masters, but the woman herself. Therefore, she doesn't want a child, no child for her. Like, that's the name of her newsletter to communicate the driving principle of you can decide what you want to do with the life that's around you. Your life is your own. So actually, as it turns out, when there is no God, there will still be masters. There is power in politics, and men are drawn to it like the ring in Tolkien's series. Now, some argue against both theocracy and theonomy because those only existed in Old Testament Israel, and really that depends on how we, on what we emphasize, how tightly we define the terms. Because I would agree, there has only been one Yahwehian theocracy, like capital T theocracy. There's only been one of those Yahwehian theocracies, which was before Saul was anointed king of Israel. And that was it. There's not actually ever been another one like it, where there will not be a king. There has only been one capital T theonomy under the Mosaic capital L law, with every civil law and penalty to be enforced in the nation of Israel. And even when Jesus returns, he will have his own law, which isn't the Mosaic law. So even there, there's really only been one season of history when that existed. In fact, the Westminster Confession, chapter 19, all of it is about God's law and how we interact with it. And in chapter 19, section 4, it explicitly states that the Mosaic law is no longer binding, quote, further than the general equity thereof may require. So kind of leaves open the idea that there could be some principles from it, but we don't obey it like national Israel had to obey the Mosaic law. But because there has only been the one theocracy, and because there has only been one capital T theonomy, that just does not mean the same thing as saying that men can make up laws as they please regardless of God. When men try to do that, they're going to decide things that lead to death and lead to falling over cliffs at some rate of speed, where there may or may not be branches that you can grab onto while you fall. So there are some alt-theos. That was just my supposed-to-be funny way. You know, you've got the right and the alt-right. Well, you've got the theo, and then you've got alt-theos. And in particular, when it comes to theonomy, because my title is Theonomy, Theona You, which I will refer explicitly in a little bit. But there are alt-theos of law, because there's always an authority. In our situation, there's always an authority by which our legislative branch writes laws. They're giving some reason, good or bad, based on some authority, for why they're writing the laws that they do. Our judicial branch interprets by some authority, and our executive branch enforces by some authority. Some type of authority, some god of the system, is going to be called in no matter what. It's not whether but which, whether or not but which one. Some authority will be applied on the social level, whether it's honestly or covertly, whether it's explicitly or ignorantly. There are options to theonomy. We'll call them alt theos. So the authority could be an authority that every man has for himself. That is called anarchy, when every man makes up his own laws as he wants. I am going to be making up some other words here. I'm also going to call it egonomy. So, because theonomy is Greek and Greek God and law, so egonomy is the individual, the I and law. The French Revolution really tried, as long as they could, to maintain this egonomy, where everybody did what was right in their own eyes. And turns out, when everybody does what is right in their own eyes, a lot of people die. It doesn't lead to freedom. It leads to death. So that is not a profitable alt-theo, is every I. It could be one man So as opposed to every individual man, it could be one man. And so that could be from the best case, a good monarch, to a bad monarch, a one person tyrant. I am going to call that big economy. or extra bad. I don't know. Big economy. The Caesars worked this. King John Young II, he's still around. We could have chosen some Russians, some Germans, one German in particular. The one man being the god of the system, making the rules as he wants them. It could be all men. So each one individually, or one over, or all men somehow collectively or together. A form of that could be democracy. Homonomy would be homo as in for man. Homonomy would be man's laws. A democracy is fine. Maybe Rousseau and some of the guys who said that all government is basically a social contract where people through their reason and logic are able to come up with things that are good for everybody. Sometimes it was more pragmatic, sometimes it was more abstract and philosophical, but the social contract is kind of connected to that. You could have representatives of men, and that would be more like what we have in a republic, and antiprosopo is a delegate in Greek. I had to make that up today. You're getting what I could find. So that would be delegates' law on behalf of the ones that have delegated them or they're representing. Athens was an old republic. Athens and Sparta were both republics. Calvin preferred a republic and tried to make that happen in Geneva. Our beloved United States of America is a dilapidated republic, a crappy republic, a bureaucratic machine republic, a not good one, but technically that's what we still are. You could have the state, which still is like the one providing the laws. That is like communism. So officially, comrade, you're not allowed to have, you know, the king, but it is the state. And the state is like this concept, this principle, this idea. And there, of course, are leaders at the top of the state. But in its best case scenario, the state is faceless, is nameless. And then you could have an idol. So Islam has a law. Sharia law is enforced on behalf of Allah. So that's just one example of the alt theos that we could have to the God of the Bible. What all of these have in common is that they make man or an idol of man the God. Every one of those is from man. Even the idol, as we know, idols are made up by men. So all of these are man-making laws and trying to be the governor of the system. It's part of the reason why my title is both playful but earnest. Theonomy, Theona you. It is very earnest because there are only two options. Either we acknowledge Jesus as Lord in our laws and government and politics, or we say that someone else is Lord over that. Is either Jesus is Lord or Jesus is not Lord. In logic, that's called the law of the excluded middle. You can't have it be both true and false. Jesus is Lord of all, or he is not. So we can recognize him as that. We can try to hide it as that. But if he is, then he is. If he's not, then there's some other God that's over the system. There is no neutronomy. It's not the neutron dance. That was a song from the 80s. There is no great God somewhere called neutrality who passes down laws for us to not have to see or represent or recognize one God rather than another. Neutrality is a thick fungus that covers deadly disease. And Jesus as Lord is clearly something that unbelievers don't want to hear about, but is actually surprising how many Christians argue more about not calling Jesus as Lord over the system than the unbelievers. I get why the unbelievers don't want to hear it, but the number of Christians who don't want to talk about Jesus as Lord in the public square, other than for sake of evangelism, is kind of crazy. I would probably use the word crazy less than Dave did in his session, but that's a good word for it. Synonyms, nuts. Synonyms, straight out of the pit. It's Christians who are arguing against recognizing God as the lawgiver, as God as the authority and the standard in a public way. Now, there are problems with a lowercase t theonomy. Because I tried to make a distinction about the uppercase T, like the capital T theonomy with the Mosaic capital L law. But that doesn't mean that we can just make up whatever laws that we want apart from acknowledging God and Christ the Lord. That said, there are reasonable concerns expressed when Christians start talking about Christian politics and Christian laws. There are some problems. One of those problems is that the church isn't the state, and I totally believe that. But this is where, you know, so as you're talking with people and you're asking them what the God of their system is. So, you know, on what are you basing your authority that we should have this law instead of this law, or this should be enforced and this shouldn't be enforced? When you're having that conversation with other people, it's part of the reason why I think if they ask you, you would be better served by being able to say, well, I understand kind of a theonomy where the law is under the authority of God, rather than theocracy, because I think theocracy has that extra baggage of through the religious leaders or through even a church structure. And I don't think that's right, let alone super helpful in the discussion. So God's law isn't mediated through the church. We don't want pastors giving speeding tickets. Or, I mean, I don't want to do any of that. That's not what we want. It is part of the reason, and some of the other guys have mentioned already, you know, it is why Kuyper's understanding of that sphere sovereignty is helpful, that there are different spheres that God has made that answer to him. Then they answered him directly. So, you know, Jim's circles that he had in his first session, where the church is not the boss of the government, nor the other way around, but they can talk to each other, that's good. But the church isn't the state. The church shouldn't try to be the state. It's not the church's job to enforce laws, political civil laws. But that's still not the same thing as saying that the government does not have obligations to acknowledge Christ's lordship. Another problem is that Christians will be distracted from the gospel. And is that a possibility? Of course that's a possibility. The idea of a social gospel, you know, is an issue where then temporal things get more attention than souls. That's possible. Now, as I said previously, I don't know any Christians who think that the state is going to save someone. I suppose I've run into Christians who think that it is more important to give clean water or stable buildings or, you know, food to the homeless and clothing to poor people. who do actually then get so consumed in that sort of work that they forget to actually tell anybody about salvation. It is possible to lose focus, but a consistent disciple should look for times to say why and for whom they're holding a position. Well, why are you giving me these clothes? Well, why are you voting against this levy? Why are you having a sign in your yard for this candidate? Now, you don't have to immediately step in it by saying, Jesus is Lord. Kneel down. I'm not suggesting that be how you have the conversation. But, like, isn't that really the reason why we do what we do? Well, because of the gospel, Jesus saved me to recognize him whatever I'm doing. And so I think that because he is my ultimate master, I think he would be pleased if I voted this way, if I worked to promote this particular policy. And in fact, when Jesus saves a person, he gives them his Holy Spirit and actually enables them to live in a way that pleases him and blesses other people. So is it possible for Christians to get distracted from the gospel by caring about God being the authority for big laws? It's possible, but not inevitable. Another problem would be Christians getting tempted to use earthly means and justify those earthly means to accomplish the successful ends. We could call this kind of a baptized Machiavelli. In Lux, you know, Jim was giving a shout out for Lux. We just finished reading The Prince by Machiavelli, along with Macbeth by Shakespeare, and had some great discussion about what Machiavelli was promoting. Like it or not, I mean, this would be the problem, is baptizing and taking most of what Machiavelli says in terms of just being successful. And again, this could certainly be a possible problem, but a Christian who is tempted to use earthly means is not being a good Christian. Like, earthly means in terms of, like, sinful manipulation and coercion. That is not a problem with what the Christian is doing. That's a problem with how the Christian is doing it. That's a problem with discipleship, his own discipleship. It is possible to disobey Jesus in the name of Jesus. It's possible to disobey Jesus in the name of Jesus when you're in the middle of playing the game, but it is also possible to disobey Jesus in his name by sitting on the sidelines when he called your number 5 minutes ago to get in there. So, like, you can disobey him by wrongly playing the game that he's called you to. You can disobey him by just sitting there and complaining about how everybody else is doing it when he told you to go play. So another problem is Christians will become proud in their power. What if we had an actual Christian president, not just one that James Dobson says is a Christian, but like that actually looked like a Christian. It was hard to find video clips of him mocking people with disabilities. Just start there. So a Christian who got into a position, you know, legislatively or executively or whatever it is, it's similar to some of the above problems. And yes, Christians have failed to be humble. In fact, some of the criticisms that I read against theonomists and kind of their close sibling called Reconstructionists, capital R Reconstructionists, a lot of the criticisms that I read against modern-day promoters of theonomy or this Reconstructionism idea, a lot of the criticisms were against their leaders for being jerks. It wasn't a lot of actual interaction with the arguments or the inescapable principle that there's always got a system. It was, well, they turned out to be not nice. And that is a big problem. But again, all of these are a failure of applying our confession, not the result of following it consistently. There isn't a problem yet where you say Jesus is Lord and you actually live like that's true. None of those above things is living truthfully according to the confession. So there would be problems. But the problem is not with recognizing that Jesus is Lord. The problem is being unfaithful, being a bad steward, and just using that as a banner or a title over it. The subtitle of the seminar today is Give Me Politics or Give Me Death. It's an intentional play off of Patrick Henry's 1775 speech in Virginia, trying to persuade Virginia to send soldiers into the battle against the British for their independence. Patrick Henry was successful in getting the Virginians to take up their guns, not in trying to have their guns confiscated like Virginia voted last week. Virginia, at least you're not West Virginia. But some of them are going to go to West Virginia. I did actually see that, I think it was the governor of West Virginia said that they would be a sanctuary for the Virginians who wanted to hold their guns. That's great. But the two comments are intended to actually be the same. Either we have a God of the system, a God of the politics, who provides us with laws that honor him and promote the life and liberty of his image bearers in their relationships and responsibilities as citizens, or we will have some kind of man-made system of laws. And when you have a man or men over the system, they will, of themselves, promote power and selfishness and death. The more that we have gotten away from our own humility before God as a nation, we have men, women making up their own rules, and it is leading to purposeful death of the weak on both ends, you know. So in womb and euthanasia. So that is what you get when men run the system, is death, not life. Now, Christians, we can withdraw, we can hide, we can build bunkers. The Benedict option is based off of the Benedictine monks, and so the whole book about the Benedict option is it's getting really bad, so kind of try to circle the wagons in your Christian community and like just wait it out. And then you can reemerge when all of the unbelievers have killed themselves, and then you can establish a new society. That's just waiting to watch death happen. That's not actually promoting life. It's preserving our own lives for a while. What if we openly acknowledged natural law, which, by the way, the strict modern-day capital T theonomists deny. They don't want to recognize natural law at all. And depending on where they're at in the spectrum, their strictness of it, everything in the Mosaic law, every penal part of the Mosaic law should get put back into effect. I'm not advocating for that kind of theonomy. But what if we openly acknowledge natural law, which requires us to say, well, who made nature? God. And also then the principles from his word in both of the testaments, so that others could see our honesty, our goals, and have actually something solid to argue against. And you know who the people are who are most fussy about that idea? Are Christians. Abraham Kuyper wrote a book called Our Program, A Christian Political Manifesto, in which he was trying to describe the policies that his political party would try to support if they were brought to power. For what it's worth, Kuyper's political party that he started was the Anti-Revolutionary Party. That was the name of it. In particular, anti the way that the French tried to do a revolution. No God, no masters. The name of his political party was to be everything that that was not. So as he is trying to explain and get to even some of the particular policies, he says, to be sure, we understand perfectly well that there are people who do not want, or there are people who do not embrace this revelation as coming from God. But what we do not understand is that there are people who accept this word of God with deep reverence and yet do not want to involve its directives in political administration, legislation, and the justice system. That is worse than being inconsistent. That we do not hesitate to say it is tantamount to professing a truth while not really believing it. To be guilty of moral fence-sitting that is bereft of all sincerity. Or if you will, it is playing with the sacred that is unworthy of a person of character. Now I know that what you still really need are some tips. I always feel like we can't end a seminar without tips. So I have some tips. Those of you who don't know, this is Jocko, and I've had him in a slide the last few seminars, so just seemed like a way to honor Jesus as Lord. I think that you should care. Does God care? If God cares, then you should care. If he doesn't care how you relate to your neighbors, then you are free to take the ostrich approach if you want. Bury your head. Take the Christian ostrich approach. Bury your head in the Bible. If God does care, then you are obligated to care. And as I said at the beginning, Christians are largely the ones who have surrendered their responsibilities. We have been irresponsible with our talents. I think you should confess Jesus as Lord. Do it with wisdom, do it with grace, do it with courage. Let the politicians know that Jesus is Lord by worshiping the Lord on the Lord's Day and by praying in dependence on the Lord for your needs and by recognizing that Jesus is the refuge, not the state. Don't let them be the Messiah. Just confess Jesus as Lord. You should definitely invest your talents, by which I'm emphasizing your political wealth. Maybe all God gave you was voting. All right? Don't bury your vote in a drawer. And then when Jesus comes back, say, well, but I did at least read the pamphlet. I just didn't turn it in and mark anything. Pick up a voter registration packet. Now, maybe in terms of your talents, he, the Lord, also gave you some ideas, some strength, some speaking ability, some knowledge of budgets and self-control. And so maybe some of you would be wrong not to run for some political office. Man, I have never heard a pastor say you would be in sin for not running for political office. I think that's everybody. I'm just saying, maybe. Where are they going to come from? So maybe he gave you time and enough followers on Facebook. Be a keyboard jockey for Jesus and, you know, work on your meme game. And interact with people and see when you can stir it up or when you can calm it down. Any one of those things. Maybe he gave you friends to talk about these things. Maybe he gave you a front yard for a sign. Maybe he gave you kids to enculturate so that the next generation is at least not further down the cliff than we currently are. Also, you should obey God ruthlessly and obviously, which includes confessing Jesus' name before men. It also includes not being hypocrites. That's important for platform, but it's also necessary preparation and protection from disobeying the Lord in a position of power. If you're not obeying him now, why would you be obeying him later when you have more authority to write laws or enforce them? Men aren't faithful with much who aren't faithful with little. A life of blessed obedience is right, and it's part of the program. You should seek to bless your neighbors, which, like in Proverbs 24:10-12, it says that if you have strength, then you should protect the weak. Rescue those who are being taken away to death. Hold back those who are stumbling to the slaughter. If you say, "Behold, we did not know this," does not he who weighs the heart perceive it? Does not he who keeps watch over your soul know it? And will he not repay man according to his work? I don't read those verses without thinking about abortion. If we don't fight against abortion Christianly, then how are we blessing our weak neighbors? It includes, blessing our neighbors includes not just honoring your marriage bed. Hebrews 13:4 requires that. But you really want to bless your neighbors, then you should seek to have all marriage beds honored, which can't happen with two men in it, or seven wives in it, or your dog that you married in it. Like that, that's not honoring the marriage bed. That has political implications for our neighbors. It includes living with peaceably with all men as much as possible, which I think includes having a Christian idea about tax rates and restitution versus prison and private property. So the means of blessing our neighbors are not just telling them the good news of the gospel, but actually following some of the principles that the Lord has given us. And then lastly, last tip, you should remember the final judgment. In the parable of the talents, Jesus said to those who had invested what he'd given them, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master." That's not what he said to the one who buried the talent. So Jesus claims full authority over your life as a disciple, wherever that life takes you. And he will expect a complete account of all that he gave you, which includes, among other things, your political life. We've been around as a church for 9 years, and we have had 2 days in which we have emphasized politics, which is not a high percentage. But it includes your political life. Jesus is Lord is that fixed starting point, the first political principle. And hopefully you're seeing that the goal here is not just to tear everything down. The goal is to build fearlessly on Jesus' Lord, on that confession. So there is actually a lot to do that is not just shrieking, shrill, complaining, fussing, grumbling, like every person on TV who doesn't like what somebody else has said. There is plenty to do. So may he help us do that. In his name.